From Fortress Fund Managers, this is Do It for Grantley, a podcast where we speak with women and men in Barbados about their Grantleys and other money matters. I'm Kim Howard, Marketing Manager at Fortress, and my co-host is Omar Kennedy.
Hello, listeners.
An entrepreneur, author, and former financial manager. The COVID-19 pandemic has upended the world, disrupting life as we knew it. Here in Barbados, more than 130 people have recovered from the virus, while 7 have lost their lives. We have experienced closed borders, a national lockdown, and unprecedented unemployment benefit claims. All while we have seen greater online service offerings, along with innovative entrepreneurial growth. So for this, our fourth season, we'll be taking a look at some of the challenges, lessons, and successes that continue to emerge as we all battle this crisis. Today, we're happy to have with us a Barbadian economist who has a keen interest in emerging markets and developing economies, having worked here in Barbados and regionally before his current assignment took him to the USA. A former featured guest at our 2018 annual Fortress Investment Forum, he's also the immediate past president of the Barbados Economic Society and is in the process of completing his PhD in economics with the University of Glasgow. Shane Lowe joins us from his home in Washington, D.C. for today's episode, Life Disrupted. We appreciate you taking the time to listen to us, so let's get to it.
Financial security doesn't grow on trees. It's built brick by brick with smart investments and a strong partner. To retirement, education, and whatever your future may hold, we say bring it on. At Fortress Fund Managers, we're not afraid of the hard work, long hours, or steady saving, just like you aren't. We know better than anyone that you can't just hope for good luck. Call Fortress Fund Managers on 435-7777 to build your personal fortress.
Your future, our business. Fortress.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Do It for Grantley, our new season. Today, we're joined by Shane Lowe. Hi, Shane.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you doing?
Pretty good as well.
All right. Shane is an economist, a Barbadian economist, who's currently based in the U.S. in Washington, D.C. And of course, we have Omar Kennedy, our co-host. How are you, Omar?
I'm fantastic. It's great to be back. Awesome.
Okay. Glad to have you as well. So tell us a little bit, Shane, about you and how you ended up being in Washington, D.C. What took you there?
Yeah. So as you said, I'm a Barbadian, typical Barbadian from St. Andrew. I am a big fan of Puddin' House. If I'm yeah. In terms of how I came to be in D.C., so I used to work some time ago at the Central Bank and then at a commercial bank in Barbados. And then a colleague of mine let me know that there was an international organization in the U.S. that was hiring economists. And so I was like, okay, I just looked and I applied. And then within a week or two, they had given me an interview and offered me the job. So then I came up pretty quickly. In my previous job, I used to cover countries in the Caribbean, about 17 countries. And now I get to cover countries not only in the Caribbean, but across the world. So that much is pretty exciting. So that's why I took the opportunity to come up.
Awesome. That must have been quite a leap.
Yeah, it was. I think culturally a bit. You know, U.S. is someplace that I never thought I would live, at least not so soon in my life. But I have lived overseas before in the U.K. So I guess it wasn't as big an adjustment as if I hadn't. I guess the biggest thing I miss is, you know, like I said, the cultural aspects of things. So the food and the music, even though there wasn't crop over this year, I do enjoy Calypso as well. So okay. I think those are the biggest things, just the cultural aspects that I miss. And friends and family, of course.
Of course. So I guess that's a segue to, you know, being away from home during the COVID-19 pandemic, you know, and, you know, in some parts of the world, it's not really showing any signs of slowing down. So Shane, when you first became aware of the virus existence, do you ever think that would be possible to cause a global shift the way it has?
I mean, the first time I heard about it was, I actually think I was in Barbados in very early January. I had just come back for Christmas. And I heard about this virus in China. But it was just a few cases at a time. And I remember coming back here, and I think it was around January 20th or so. The IMF usually has this update to their global economic outlook. And they were actually predicting an acceleration in growth this year for the global economy. So even they didn't think that COVID would have this impact. So I think it's caught everyone by surprise. At least I can speak for myself. I think what has happened, though, is that it shows how globally integrated the world is, that you can have a virus that starts, you know, in one part of the world, and it just spreads so rapidly because people are always moving back and forth. Mm-hmm. And I think given this slowdown in travel, or the pretty much travel stopped altogether in some places, it kind of shows how dependent, not just tourism-dependent economies are, but everyone is for movement of people and doing business around the world.
Definitely. And this, I mean, this season for Do It For Grantly, we're focusing on COVID-19 and its fallout and impact on people, the economy, and just personal finances, as well as company finances, the way that people have been able to respond in various ways for good or ill. And just to remind everyone, Do It For Grantly is produced by Fortress Fund Managers. This is our fourth season.
Yes, it is.
It's our
I can't believe it.
It's our fourth season, and we already have 19 episodes available for people to listen to, ranging in all kinds of topics from saving versus investing, family money matters, investing in your health, millennial investors, retirement planning. There's a whole range, and it's all available on our website, fortressfund.com. And I also wanted to remind you that we are encouraged, you know, by your listenership. We do get a lot of feedback from people, you know, people telling us, or somebody's running into us and telling us, you know, they enjoy the podcast, they liked a particular point that somebody made. And it's always good to hear that. So thank you for listening to us these past couple of seasons, and we hope that you enjoy this current season. Right. So then tell us a little bit more, Shane. You talked about how travel came to a halt, and, you know, it was a bit of a surprise for everybody. On a personal level, and also on a professional level, how would you say the pandemic has affected you? We've had quite a few months since you first heard about it in January.
On a personal level, I mean, it's difficult to, I am an introverted person, but having said that, you know, I still like to be outside sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so I think in mid-March, the office closed down pretty abruptly. And so that meant that you don't have the opportunity to socialize or just to meet with your colleagues. You're always cooped up in a house or an apartment. In terms of where I live, I can still go outside to the supermarket and do things pretty normally throughout the entire pandemic. That may be a positive in some aspects, but a negative given the fact that the virus hasn't slowed down. On a professional level, I think the transition to home-based work was pretty seamless. I think the biggest challenge for me, given the type of work I do, covering economies and looking at the risk in these economies, is that risk has risen everywhere. So that's more work for me, I suppose. So that has been a bit challenging. And I find that you do work a bit more, a few more hours at home than in the office. So you don't have the commute time, but you do have more work to do. So I guess it's a bit of balance. Being at home is nice, but also you do more work, and it is nice to be able to see people sometimes.
So you mentioned something very important. A lot of persons during the lockdowns have said that their productivity has increased because they're no longer as stressed because of the long commutes, which they have. Some persons, they may live 15 minutes away from work, but the traffic on the road makes it seem like 45, you know. So, you know, I do think you made a very valid point that, you know, your productivity can increase. You can feel freer to work more hours because you don't have that additional stress of getting up, getting in your car, being annoyed in traffic, then getting to work, having to settle your head to, you know, detox in the traffic, then get some work done. And, you know, you have more time to be productive.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it depends on if you want to do more work when you're at home.
Oh, well, true,
definitely,
yeah.
Definitely that is one of the benefits. So I find that I don't wake as early as I did before, and I go to bed a bit later, and I still get the same amount of sleep. So there's more that you can do during the day. I think probably the biggest challenge of all of that is making sure that there's a clear divide between work and home still, because it becomes the same physical space in many instances, unless you have like a nice separate home office where you can go to and, you know, close the door and stuff like that. You two tend to merge into each other, and then you kind of forget what relaxing feels like. You find that you're working at all hours of the day. So I think there are definitely positives there. But I think you also have to be careful not to let the two merge into each other, and then you forget what cooling off and relaxing and just taking a break feels like.
That kind of balance and separation between the two.
Yes.
Definitely.
One of the things that we've definitely noticed, aside from what you've observed and what I've also experienced, where there that separation kind of blurs with working from home, is the impact that it's had on the global economy. I don't think if you'd asked any of us on December 31st, 2019, what we thought would be the biggest issue, if we thought like a giant economic slowdown worldwide was part of what we would have envisioned. And here in Barbados, one of the biggest indicators we've had of how significant that impact has been is the record increase in unemployment, and in particular, the dispensation of unemployment benefits. How do you see that shaping up going forward, where we're at right now, and how is it different for Barbados than it might be in other places? You said you review other places in the world, not just the Caribbean now. So how does Barbados compare in that regard?
Well, I think certainly across the world, this is something that you're seeing. And I think governments all around the world are struggling with this question of how do we get people back out to work and reduce the burden on, I suppose, the unemployment funds in countries where they do have funds like that, because Barbados is special in the sense that not all countries have this automatic stabilizer, if you want to call it that. So how do you balance that against the health costs? And Barbados, from my perspective, has done a pretty good job of containing the virus and also getting people back out to work. And the Caribbean in general has done a good job. I think there are countries around the world that have, been on lockdown for far, far earlier than Barbados and far longer than Barbados as well. And so you've seen even bigger impacts on their economy. And they're not necessarily tourism-dependent economies, but if you look at some of the projections from the IMF and other sources, they're probably going to see larger output contractions than Barbados would. So I think it's definitely a burden. It will continue for some time. I mean, you might have some businesses that may have survived the initial wave, I suppose, but there's only so much more they can go. And so they may have to consider maybe reducing the workforce. But hopefully, as certain parts of the world kind of get things under control in terms of the virus, you will see a rebound in tourism. You will see more hotels reopening. You will see restaurants hiring people again. And those are the two sectors, hotels and restaurants, and the associated transportation sectors that seem to have been hit the hardest in terms of the unemployment claims so far in Barbados.
No, absolutely. We have found that. And as the tourists have come back in, you're finding one or two more hotels are opening once again, and the restaurants which had been closed, some of which catered mostly to tourists, they're now starting to pop back up again. So absolutely. But that brings us to our next point. Reportedly, the government of Barbados spent in excess of $26 million in unemployment. Unemployment benefits recording 40% unemployment, up from 10.5% pre-COVID. For many persons, especially those who are retired, the NS is their lifeline. Is this level of dispensation, well, sustainable, especially with an economy which is still mostly closed?
Clearly, if it continued for an extremely long period of time, that would be, very, very detrimental. I mean, the NAS, I imagine, has, I'm not an actuary, but I imagine, they get revenues from contributions, or they get money comes in from contributions.
Yeah.
Money also comes in from any dividends or interest payments that they have in investments, and then they pay out the claims. So hopefully they don't have to, on a regular basis, be dipping into any funds that they have stored there. And I suppose if that needs to happen, it would happen. The longer this continues, though, the more likely they would have to do something like that. Now, I think for me, the bigger issue when it comes to the NAS is the aging population. Mm-hmm. Because that means that you have fewer people on average working and more people on average receiving benefits. So that balance between the contributions and the claims becomes a bit lopsided. And the other issue as well is that, like many other financial institutions, the NAS was hit by having to restructure some of the government's debt that it held restructured. And so that meant that the interest that it got from the government's debt was reduced as well. So I think those are two issues the government will have to find a solution to. But mm-hmm. I think for now, the NAS should be okay. But I think those are the two issues that I think are probably a bit more pressing for the longevity of the fund.
Definitely. As we do know, I think GDP had fallen by about 27%. What are some of the effects that we would see among the average Barbadian with a decline in the economy?
Well, certainly the unemployment for those who can't work, especially those in the, like I said, the tourism sector and the sectors that support tourism. I think for those people who are still working, I don't think the effects might be immediate. I think what will happen, though, is that they might be effects later on. So, for example, you might find that, you definitely will find that government revenue will fall. And so the government at some point in time will have to think about how does it adjust that. And if the economy rebounds and revenue comes back, that's great. But at some point in time, the government will have to say, well, do I need to adjust rates or something to get, you know, my financial affairs back in order?
And, okay, there's two things that you mentioned there. Omar talked about GDP and you also talked about government revenue. So just for our wider audience, can you just remind us again what GDP means?
So GDP, gross domestic product, is basically all of the production in a country. So within that country. So if someone produces a chair or they plant some food and they reap it, that is counted as output, essentially. Now, the reason why that is important for revenue is that if you produce the chair and you sell it and it's taxed, then the government will receive some tax revenue. Or the more economic activity, the more people are employed, which means the more people pay income taxes, particularly at the higher end. And so that's more revenue. So you can imagine the government will be hit on both sides because on the one hand, there's the NIS who's having to pay out all of these claims. But then on the other hand, the government is receiving less revenue because fewer people are employed. And so at some point in time, unless the economy just rebounds and gets back to the level it was before, which is a bit unlikely to happen in the near term, then the government will have to think about how does it adjust. Now, how and when and will and where, that's a policy decision. So I don't want to spook people to thinking that taxes will increase or whatever, but, you know, it will have to consider what the implications of this crisis will be.
Right. And I guess that's where some creativity will be involved and possibly where we would have seen the maybe that's part of the genesis of the 12-month visa program, because that would potentially present some opportunity for some additional revenue with people who were here not just for 3 weeks or a week or whatever, but people who had to live here, buy groceries, get their hair cut, rent a car or buy a car or pay for childcare for their children if they decided to come with their children, all of those different layers that somebody who wasn't here for a short period of time would have to do.
Agreed. And even going back to what Shane said earlier, even the staple industries which were hit hardest, the restaurants, the hotels and villas, the tourism sector, transportation. So yes, I agree with you both. Those are very, very important, and that program will assist in that.
I really was struck by like the long arms of tourism, to be quite honest, because traditionally you just think about hotels and restaurants, but then there are the taxi men or women who shuttle people between those places, shuttle them from the airport. Those same taxi people also sometimes transport workers. You know, some facilities, when their workers work late, they send them home. So all of those people, the people that drive the taxi are impacted. The people who supply the food to the various restaurants and whatnot, there was like a lot of frozen chicken on the freezer that normally would not be because there was not the usual means of retailing it to restaurants and hotels that would normally take up a lot of that, more than the Barbadian population on their own would use. So it was just interesting that the very, very long arms of tourism, that's one of the things that really struck me most during the lockdown and even since then, but particularly during lockdown is when that really came home to me.
Yeah, I think it's still a very important sector. I mean, I know we always talk about diversifying, which I think is essential, but I think it still is one of the major sectors of the economy. And if you think about it, we get more than 600,000 stayover arrivals every year. I mean, they don't stay for the entire year, but as Barbados' population is less than 300,000. So we get twice the number of people coming to stay in hotels or villas or other homes during the year. Another 600,000 arrive by cruise ship as well. So, you know, if you take those 1.2 million people away from the economy, even for a short period of time, you know, you will find some impact on the economy.
Yeah, it's that is true.
You mentioned that. I believe it was on May 5th. You were quoted stating that you felt confident that the economy will rebound, albeit slowly, from the challenges posed by the COVID-19 pandemic. When do you think we'll see an uptick in the local economy's growth? And do you still hold that stance?
I think eventually it will rebound. I think timing is always very difficult because it depends a lot on what happens outside of Barbados. I think the U.S., you saw maybe a few months ago, cases were starting to fall. And then all of a sudden, they spiked to record levels. Whereas some other countries in the world, Canada and I guess UK, have come down a bit more consistently, have dealt with it a bit more. So things will rebound, yes, but I think it will be a lot more slowly than we expected. I think a lot will depend on people's trust and being able to travel. Many people still want to travel. I mean, I see comments online of Barbadians asking, why are people still traveling to Barbados? And people still want to get out. They're a bit tired of being cooped up at home, particularly in countries where the climate is a bit cold. People will still want to move around. And so I think a lot will depend on how trusting they are of the environment. That will depend on how quickly a vaccine comes about. And it will depend on how much more we know about the virus, the effects of the virus, and how we treat the virus. But certainly it's seeming more and more likely that we'll have to learn how to live with the virus, at least for a bit longer, rather than just eradicate it. So certainly not this year. This year doesn't look very positive, but I'd imagine as vaccines become available, you will see people start to get back to probably a new normal sometime next year.
Fingers and toes. I think that we have, possibly as a society, this is so far removed from anything that we know. Like we've come up in a world where, you know, you're vaccinated for the most part when you're a child. You don't even think about why is you're vaccinated, right? People do it because it's like, oh, I had to take my baby to get them vaccinated. And that's part of the process of parenting. But the reason why those vaccinations exist is because there were times when there were illnesses that could take you down quite easily. And we got to a point where we figured out how to stop some of those illnesses. So we don't even think about these things. There's still some of those illnesses still ravage parts of the world. But for the most part, in the so-called developed world, it's a non-issue. So I think we've become so comfortable and so spoiled and so separated and removed from being, oh my goodness, encumbered by a disease. How is that even possible, right? But yet here we are. So it's been a bit stark. And I was just wondering too, do you think, I keep on hearing commentary locally and overseas about not being able to withstand a second wave. But as an economist, how do you perceive how that might happen, particularly for Barbados, where we were already, you know, trying to work our way through an IMF program pre-lockdown? How do you think that we would manage under a second wave?
So I think that would be very difficult. But having said that, I think most countries around the world are probably better prepared for a second wave than they were for the first. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is that I think people have gotten used to working from home now. So the transition is going to be a bit easier. I think there are certain systems as well that have been put in place around in many countries where it comes to testing. And, you know, you saw, particularly in China when it first started, new hospitals just, you know, being built in days or weeks. So certainly it wouldn't be great at all. And I think for Barbados that has started to get back to a sense of normalcy, you know, it would put another halt in economic activity. You would see those unemployment claims rise again. But I think we're better prepared for that than we were before. People are more used to social distancing. They're more used to working from home. Some people haven't returned to work physically as yet either. So fingers crossed it doesn't happen. But hopefully we can handle a second wave a lot better than we initially did in the first.
Is there anything that countries could do? I mean, yes, so countries, you're quite right, have become more familiar with social distancing and what that would entail. Supermarket looks a lot different than it used to before. There's all these barricades that you can now separates you from the cashier or whatever the case may be, and in many other places. So there's all of those provisions that are now part of our structure. What is there anything that you see that countries failed to do before or that they should be looking to put into place just in case?
I think one interesting thing, and I've seen it in a couple countries in Latin America, is that you have some countries where the level of informality in the workforce is quite high. And what I mean by that is that, you know, you may have people going out there working, they don't necessarily pay taxes, or they're not working in the formal economy, if you like. And so what happens is that when something like this occurs, they don't have the benefit of like an NIS to fall back on. And so what that does is that it forces them to then have to go out to still try to work, even though there's a lockdown. And then they get ill and they pass it on. And so, like I said, there are some countries where the lockdown occurred even earlier than in Barbados. But the virus still, you know, was pretty rampant because people had to go outside to work. So I think, you know, something is, I say simple, but Barbados might consider the NIS to be something that was around for years and it's just a common part of our society. But something like that, a social safety net that allows people to, if they need to, stay at home for even if it's 3, 4, 5 months and allow you to contain the virus, I think that is very important. I think this episode has showed us that those safety nets are important, not just for people's well-being, but the simple fact that if you don't have them, people are not going to just stay at home and starve. They're going to need to go outside. So Barbados is very lucky that it has the NIS, or a safety net like that. And I think other countries might want to consider something like that going forward.
But that being said, there are a lot of people in Barbados who don't fall within that safety net, who, like you said, work informally. And they, you know, the vendor who, I mean, we did, and I do admire that we did come forward with some measures to assist like vendors. Actually, no, that was during the demolition of the old NIS building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was this year, I think, or late last
year.
Yeah.
Wow, it felt like a million years ago. But things like people like that, for example, so the government came forward and paid them, I believe, I can't remember, it was like a month's salary or some amount of money for a period because they anticipated that was the length of time it was going to take to demolish the building so that they could have them return to the area safely. But it's people like that who, when they are not out there selling whatever it is that they're selling to earn an income on a daily basis, who don't contribute to NIS, probably don't even earn enough to be able to manage a contribution as well as, you know, manage their daily expenses. I think those are the people that are most severely impacted. And yeah, I wonder about what we could do. It's one thing to have a project like that where there's a specific group of people who are going to need to be accommodated for a period of time. But over a long-term period of a couple of months, I would imagine an economy such as ours would struggle to have that kind of safety net for people who fall outside of the NIS grouping.
No, definitely. I think is, and perhaps there are other programs that can come on board that kind of help with that. I don't know how you exactly deal with that situation, because of course the state can only do so much in many instances. But I think, like I said, one thing this pandemic has certainly taught me is the value of programs like that. And maybe it's educational programs like this that teach people about saving or investing, even if they might probably earn quite a little, but ensuring that they do have that little nest egg, so to speak, for a rainy day. But I think it's very important because it's shown me that it's not only important for those people in terms of helping them to survive the pandemic, but also helping to contain a virus and spread the virus like this. But definitely something to think about.
I would like to add at this point, it would be remiss of us not to mention that Fortress Fund Managers is a mutual fund company. And what a mutual fund is, it is an investment option which pools your money together with other person's money. And Fortress, they are very, very prolific and capable fund managers. They invest that money, not just locally and regionally, but internationally for you. So it works on the principle of not putting all of your eggs in one basket. So by investing in one mutual fund, you may find yourself investing in 30 companies in your region, 200 companies internationally, you know, 30 or 40 countries, you know, across the world, you know. So you really get to not put your eggs in one basket. So when things are going badly in one market, you have another 39 markets which would lift you up. And Fortress is great for this because it really helps you diversify. And you can have a mutual fund for any purpose. We were discussing things like retirement and having an alternate stream of income. You could choose to have a mutual fund to supplement your NIS. If in case you do not believe your NIS would be enough for you, you can put a few dollars down every month into the Fortress Mutual Fund. And say in 10 years or when you retire, you can say, well, I'll take the money I've been investing out and have a supplemental nest egg there waiting for you.
Yeah,
it's true. And I think this pandemic has also pointed that out to us too, the importance of having more than one stream of income and not necessarily the kind of income where essentially you now have three jobs, but maybe a job and something else that is bringing you returns. So something that you may, what they call more passive, which is what a mutual fund is. And I saw that, and I've admired a lot of people who were able to generate additional sources of income outside of what they regularly did during the lockdown and have been able to continue doing that. So I think for all of its negatives, I think the lockdown and the pandemic has forced us to get creative in many different ways. Is there anything else you would want to share with us, Shane, in terms of outlook for the economy, both here and abroad?
Well, it might sound like a cop-out, but I think certainly the outlook is very uncertain. I think the number of times that you've seen like the IMF and these other organizations revise their forecasts, you've seen in other countries, I think in New Zealand, where people have, you know, they've had to reinstitute a lockdown. So I think it's very important that we, you know, maintain our distance where necessary and keep our guards up and ride this out, you know, for as long as it lasts.
Indeed. Thank you so much for joining us today, Shane. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
It's awesome.
Thanks for having me.
We've talked a lot today about the lessons we've learned, the things we've observed, and I would love to hear from our listeners. What are some of the things that you've learned? If you could tell us what's the main financial lesson you've learned during lockdown or since, I would love to hear from you about that. So you can send us your responses and join us next time when we speak about the tough financial lessons we've learned during and post COVID-19 lockdown. Thanks again for listening and goodbye.
See you later.
Do It for Grantley is a production of Fortress Funds Managers. You can listen to and download all our episodes in all the good places podcasts are available, including SoundCloud, Google and Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, and more. Or on our website, fortressfund.com. That's fortressfund.com, where you can also find this episode's show notes explaining all the financial terms we mentioned in the show. Remember, we want to hear from you. Tell us, what is the main financial lesson you've learned during lockdown or since? Send us a voice note at fortressfund.com/podcast, email us at info@fortressfund.com, or message us on Facebook or Instagram. You never know, we might just feature your response in an upcoming episode. Until next time, I'm Kim Howard.
And I'm Omar Kennedy.
Thanks for listening.